thing right. I'm thinking. He's just right. as fed up as I am.
Right. And they get together. They do things together.
Yeah.
Right? They take action. They challenge if certain things are not happening because it's our human nature. It's fitra.
Yeah.
Our fitra is justice seeking.
Exactly.
Okay? It's not freedom seeking in the way that Bush used to talk about it. It's justice seeking. People want justice. Okay? They're even willing to sacrifice some of their freedom for justice, as the Americans yeah. did after 9/11 in the name of seeking justice, right?
Yeah.
Right? So it's not
like
about
the Bill of Rights now. It's like completely out the window. It's like right. one by one.
And people like, are like, well, I haven't done anything, so I have nothing to fear. We're like, well, you didn't really get it, right? It's not about yeah. you. It's about somebody who's done something bad and what protections they have under the law. Okay? So the point is that, you know, it's dehumanizing. And what happened in Iran, alhamdulillah, was that we started going on this path as individuals and as a nation to reclaim our humanity.
Yeah.
Okay? It's simple as that. We are reclaiming our humanity. We have the right to be, you know, technologically advanced. We have the right to be educated. We have the right to be... I'm using the rights language of the West, okay? Yeah. So that, you know, if you want to talk rights...
Yeah.
You know, it's a human right to be advanced. It's our human right to have the latest, you know, knowledge about the sciences.
Yeah, some people they're thinking like, you know, look at we're becoming so advanced now. We got all these like new gadgets and toys and stuff. And the older generations are looking at us like, what are you guys doing? Right. It's like you don't even know who your neighbor is.
Exactly.
You're putting like, you know, real like lemon extract and like furniture polish, but then you have like artificial flavoring in your lemonade.
Right.
It's like, what the hell? It's like you got real stuff in furniture, but then you got fake stuff in your own, you know, consumption. It's
right. Like, and also the fact...
How are you advanced? But, you got an iPad, you got an iPod or whatever, you got some
The
big
thing
computer.
Is, you can never replace real communities. You know, everybody talks about virtual community, right?
People are on Facebook, I got a million friends. It's like... You got no friends.
Who cares, right? I mean, that's a small part. I'm not saying people shouldn't talk online or have friends on the other parts of the world. That's also good. There's some point to that. But you know, what's happening in where you live?
Yeah.
What's happening in where you work? What's
your
happening
community around you?
What's happening in where your children go to school? You know, what's happening there? Are you part of that? Are you involved
exactly.
in that? You know, and so.
And it's alhamdulillah, not much.
We
a lot
have
of times
people
just sitting around drinking tea or coffee with each other, talking.
Exactly, and so alhamdulillah, we have, you know, people like Imam Khomeini, may God bless him and his, and we have people like Ayatollah Khamenei, and we have good people in Iran who, you know, are going on this path of reclaiming their humanity, of being human beings, whether it's in their personal life as individuals, whether it's in their family life. And their communal life as part of a family, as part of a city, as part of a community, or whether it's as a nation in their national life, trying to, you know, have a political system where people take part in their destiny, which I think is the most important thing. You know, having development where, as you said, you know, we really don't have people dying of hunger in Iran.
Yeah.
We, you know, most areas of the country have electricity, water, you know, whatever those basic needs are, education,
yeah, like
medical
in Iran,
care.
It's surprising. You don't see people going hungry or homeless. You know, I'm sure that there is a small percentage, but it's not like anywhere in a
well,
Western
society. Well, I mean,
just look at the
medical system that we have. You know, we have a vast country. You know, Iran is a huge country.
Yeah.
Okay? It's the size of Western Europe, just to put it in perspective. Of all of Western Europe, that's one Iran, okay? And we have rural health care, which is, you know, world standard.
Yeah.
Okay. These are things that add value to one's life, whether it's the government paying for it, whether it's, you know, government medicine, whatever, these things that they always throw about in the States about, you know, Obamacare, whatever. Who cares? Who cares if the government's paying for it? Right?
Exactly.
It increases the value of people's lives and the you know, quality of their life. So we have a high quality of life here. And all of it is based on the blessing of Islam and following the path of real Islam with real Islamic leaders.
Very
like
good
Imam
point.
Khomeini.
A very good point. And a very good point to end on. Well, that's our show, The Man Who Changed the World. We thank you for tuning in. Once again, I'm your host, Sayyid Jabari, here with our guest speaker, Okay, make the Torabi. Thank you for being here with us again today. And thank you for tuning in. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the limelight.
Nothing better illustrates the cruelty and destructiveness of economic warfare than the current situation in Afghanistan, which is being subjected to the equivalent of a blockade because of the outcome of a war that the US and its allies lost. The people of Afghanistan are now being starved because the US and US-led international institutions refuse to accept the reality of that defeat. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Daniel Larrison Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Economic Warfare is Killing Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. The economic war on Afghanistan is taking a deadly toll on the population as the country has been cut off from all but a trickle of humanitarian aid. Roughly 23 million people are facing acute food insecurity as a result, and that number is liable to grow if the international response remains as limited and piecemeal as it has been. Nothing better illustrates the cruelty and destructiveness of economic warfare than the current situation in Afghanistan, which is being subjected to the equivalent of a blockade because of the outcome of a war that the United States and its allies lost. The people of Afghanistan are now being starved because the US and the US-led international institutions refuse to accept the reality of that defeat. It is inexcusable that the same governments that kept Afghanistan so independent on external support for the last 20 years have yanked away that support when it is most needed for the Afghan people to survive and recover. It is incumbent on the U.S. and these institutions to alleviate the massive suffering that their policies are creating.
as Esfandiar Batmanglij and Erika Muret explained in a recent article for Foreign Affairs, U.S. sanctions have combined with other cutoffs in funding to send Afghanistan into economic collapse. They said these measures, together with capital flight from the country and confusion over what is permitted under the UN and U.S. sanctions against Taliban, has precipitated a major liquidity crisis and the collapse in the value of the Afghan currency, leading to sharp price increases in the import-dependent country. The collapse in Afghan purchasing power is so severe that the UN Development Program forecasts that 97% of Afghans could fall below the poverty line by the middle of 2022. As they make clear, it is no accident that sanctions are striking at Afghans' purchasing power, since this is what broad sanctions are designed to do. This economic weapon is hitting Afghanistan even harder than it has hit other countries because the country has practically nothing to fall back on, and that makes the use of it against Afghanistan even more outrageous. Broad sanctions always hurt the population much more than they damage the targeted government. It would be indefensible to starve a population to achieve regime change in any case. But collective punishment of the population never leads to the political and policy changes that sanctions advocates say they want. The Times of London quoted Mary Ellen McGroarty, country director of the World Food Program, WFP, in a recent report on the disastrous conditions, you cannot condition humanitarian support. This is a country where 75% of its budget was foreign assistance. If we don't send money, people will die. Should the children of Afghanistan starve? Is that punishing the Taliban? Besides sanctions relief, unfreezing Afghan government assets is critical to reviving the country's economy in the near term. As David Beasley, head of WFP, told Jane Ferguson earlier this year, if you unfreeze the money, then you can put liquidity back into the marketplace, and the economy will start to come back up. If you don't, we're not going to need to feed 22 or 23 million people per month. We are going to need to be feeding 35 million people. This country will absolutely collapse, unquote. In addition to the horrifying loss of life that would follow, this will also produce a massive refugee crisis that will place heavy strains on all of Afghanistan's neighbors, where hundreds of thousands of refugees have already fled. The Biden administration may be reluctant to take the necessary actions for fear of hawkish attacks that they are rewarding the Taliban, but they have to know that they will face these ingenuous hawkish attacks no matter what they do. The minimal aid that they are facilitating now is not nearly enough to address a humanitarian crisis as severe and extensive as this one. The crisis is bound to get worse if the economy does not get the infusion of cash that it needs to function, and it is largely within the U.S. government's power to make that happen. The Afghanistan case is a stark reminder that sanctions kill, and they can be more deadly than a military campaign. Broad sanctions are not a real alternative to war. They are simply another means of inflicting death and destruction on the targeted country because they are so damaging and indiscriminate. Broad sanctions should be rejected as an instrument of policy.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the news line.
Israel announced on July 22nd that it had been granted an observer status in the influential African Union after unsuccessful lobbying for nearly 20 years. Since the disbandment of the Organization of African Unity in 2002, Israel had made futile attempts to join the African Union, which replaced the OAU. However, the move was always thwarted by members of the Union, who even called for an end to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in February. The crisis was set in motion last July when Moussa Faki Mahamat, chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's accreditation to the 55-member body headquartered in Addis Ababa, triggering a rare dispute within a body that values consensus. Powerful AU member states, notably South Africa and Algeria, quickly spoke out in protest, saying they had not been properly consulted and that the move contradicted numerous AU statements showing their support for the Palestinian territories.
The reason that there are such fierce divisions with regards to the matter of Israel and the African Union, Israel having observer status, is the manner in which Israel became secured its observer status. The decision was taken unilaterally by the African Union head instead of through the consensus procedures that the African Union is accustomed to. In other words, it was forced on the African Union.
In contradiction to his decision just 2 months before accepting Israel's accreditation, Faki himself condemned Israeli bombardments in the Gaza Strip, as well as violent attacks by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds, saying the Israeli army was acting in stark violation of international law. But now Faki has defended his decision, claiming that it could be an instrument in the service of peace. However, Palestinian resistance movements hit back, with Hamas calling on all freedom-loving Africans to voice solidarity with the Palestinian nation and compel Faki to revoke the decision. Hamas said in a statement that reads, "The occupying regime has long practiced state terrorism and systematically commits all kinds of crimes against the Palestinian people, their territories and holy sites. It enacts a policy of ethnic cleansing and racial discrimination as documented by many international human rights organizations." So, how could granting membership or even an observer status to Israel serve as an instrument in the service of peace? While the African Union's main goals are rejecting racism, demanding decolonization, and the right to self-determination. Experts say Israel's observer status is largely seen as part of Tel Aviv's continued campaign to normalize ties in Africa.
When countries expand their ties with Israel, they usually do so in order to get access to Congress or in Washington or the White House. And African countries have been seeking, of course, lobbying access to the Congress and the White House, and believe that ties with Israel helps them.
Back in August, the Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtan Lamamra condemned the decision to grant Israel an observer status at the bloc as a huge mistake. He also chastised the chairman of the AU Commission for defending his decision, saying insistence on the measure will eventually result in the breakup of the regional organization. But what is Tel Aviv after? Israel's AU observer status would pave the way for normalization with African states. In recent years, it has successfully done this with Chad, Sudan, and Morocco. But it's also viewed as an attempt to influence the continent on diplomatic issues. Also, Israel couldn't have normalized ties with these countries without Washington's help. The U.S. used economic or other types of incentives to broker normalization deals between African countries and Israel. For instance, on the same day Sudan signed the U.S.-sponsored deal to normalize ties with Israel, Washington signed a memorandum of understanding with Khartoum to clear $1 billion of the country's arrears to the World Bank. Also, as part of the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel, the U.S. recognized Rabat's sovereignty over Western Sahara, a disputed region claimed by both Morocco and the Algeria-backed Polisario Front.
So the reality here is that there is a recognition that the Palestinian people are continuing to suffer, but political interests, narrow political interests, perhaps naive and very crude political interests, have given rise to this very awkward dilemma for the African Union that threatens, in the words of the Algerian foreign minister, to rip apart the African Union if a solution cannot be found to this the solution being, of course, removing the observer status from Israel.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or to abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Lately, international rights groups have accused the Tel Aviv regime of imposing apartheid on Palestinians. This is while Washington provides the regime with around $3 billion in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions. So, doesn't joining the African Union only prepare the ground for Tel Aviv to spread its evil further? The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic pitch. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantee that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the US and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a US ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there. Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. You know, in Libya, the invisible airplanes. Apparently, Russian satellites just couldn't see them that were supposedly strafing protesters. That, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection. Or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate a pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The list of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encouraged the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bathizi, 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 Ey Shahidon Erohe Khuda, Ey Karde, Bahre Ehyoye Haq Jon Fada, Kas Patre, Patre Ye Khune Pake Shoma, Mi Ruyad, Ta Abad Dar Vatan Nale Ha, Barfizi, 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 Barfizi.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
Tens of accomplishments have been made in different parts of the Islamic Republic, some of which I have mentioned in the statement of the second step of the revolution. We must speak about these great achievements of the Islamic Republic and remind the people and those who forget these things. So this is another point that needs to be considered. Another point is the issue of being among the people. Well, thankfully, the government that is in office today has good relations with the people. It shows its presence among the people. Its popular movement is tangible, but this must be completed. First of all, it must continue. Now, some individuals are questioning this course of action, but they should be ignored. It is very tiring to constantly be present among the people, even for government officials. It is hard work and it is not easy. But it is very effective. It is very good and it must continue. Secondly, they must fulfill the promises that have been made to the people. These promises must be fulfilled in the allotted time so that people will know that this is serious.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It may not be possible to fulfill a promise. There are cases when a promise is made, but in practice, the background has not been prepared for it to be put into practice. In such cases, they must go to those people to whom this promise was made and explain things clearly. They should state the reasons why they could not fulfill that promise and say that they will do their best to fulfill it at a later time, insha'Allah. This is another point which is about fulfilling the promises that have been made to the people. Another point is that sometimes experts and specialists who are from among the people suggest ideas and solutions to the officials for different sectors. Officials should come up with a mechanism in order to be able to benefit better from these ideas. And this will actually help people to participate in the decisions of the responsible organizations of the country. This is one point. In addition, in order to benefit from the capabilities that are available in the people in practice, they should come up with another mechanism so that they can help the people participate in action as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, Conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's being driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as prime minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Site for is up, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Ali Safir, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed their country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent. Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that they have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day, and now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen in the U.S.-backed Saudi led war against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities. Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city, calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic. It's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more overtly like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. So because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtaya, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution